I'm Ron Barr, and welcome to this special World Airways in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA. Sports Byline is America's sports talk show and is heard on more than 200 U.S. radio stations, Sirius Satellite Radio, as well as worldwide on the Internet and the more than 500 stations of the American Forces Radio Network. On this special in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA, we'll talk to Jerry Rice, considered the greatest receiver in the history of the NFL, about his journey from rural Mississippi to the Hall of Fame. And we'll continue talking football with former Raiders coach Tom Flores, who led the Silver and Black to two Super Bowl titles. He writes about it all in his book, Tales from the Oakland Raiders. And Darrell Evans, probably the most underrated player in baseball history, will share his thoughts about the ups and downs of his 21-year career. So sit back and enjoy this special in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA. First up, Jerry Rice. I had the pleasure of watching Rice's career from the day he was drafted by the 49ers through 20 seasons and now into the NFL Hall of Fame. Coach Bill Walsh saw something special in Rice, even though he played his college ball at Little Mississippi Valley State. His early NFL years were marked by inconsistency and drop passes. But when his career was over, Rice had won three Super Bowls with the Niners, owned 38 different NFL records, including records for receptions, yards, and touchdowns. Also, Rice had the good fortune of being on the receiving end of passes thrown by two of the greatest quarterbacks to ever play the game, Joe Montana and Steve Young. Even after his playing days were over, Rice proved he still had the moves as he competed in television's Dancing with the Stars. Whatever Jerry Rice has done in his life, he's done it full out and with great success. He wrote about his life on and off the field in his book, Go Long, My Journey Beyond the Game and Fame. I asked him why he wrote the book.
I wanted people with this book. I just really didn't want this to be just a sports book. I wanted people to know about my childhood, about going to Mississippi Valley State, then, the adversity coming here to San Francisco and not having confidence at times. And it was almost like it was that fear of failure, you know, that was driving me. My father, he was a bricklayer, and I would go out and work with him. And if I didn't do my job, he would discipline me. So I never wanted to let him down. Then I never wanted to let the San Francisco 49ers down or the fans.
So the fear of failure was something that drove you pretty strongly.
Yeah, it pushed me. It pushed me. So, and I never got complacent. I never felt like I arrived. You know, you would hear people say, well, you know, you are the best receiver to play the game. I never looked at it that way. You know, I just continued to work hard. I would go to training camp, and I would play head games with myself. It was a scenario where I just felt, hey, I'm a rookie here. I have to prove myself to make this football team, and that was my approach for years.
How did you deal with mediocrity when you ran into it, either on a teammate or just generally speaking in life then?
You know what?
I mean, that's got to be tough when you're somewhat of a perfectionist like yourself.
I was always searching for that perfect game. I was always searching for it, and I never got it because, you know, I could have a game where I have 8 to 10 catches, over 160 yards, three scores or something like that, and I go back and I look at that, and I say, well, you know, I missed that block. You know, that block could have, opened the door for Roger Craig or something like that. So I was always searching for it, and I think I was driven by it.
When you go back and you think about where you came from in Mississippi and now where you are today, all you've accomplished, I mean, it's got to be mind-blowing. Because I knew Jerry Rice when he was a rookie, an unpolished rookie, had trouble putting sentences together,
right.
Overwhelmed by the media, was right. Dropping passes early in his career. I mean, to me, it's a time warp. It just is mind-blowing to see how far you have come.
You know what? I never go back. I really don't. I'm always moving forward. And I think I've been blessed because, you know, I've been around so many great people. And, you know, Eddie DeBartolo, Carmen Policy, Dwight Clark, Freddie Solomon, Joe Montana, Steve Young, just so many guys. And I sat back and I watched those guys and how they dealt with the media. And it was hard for me at first, but I think I have grown a lot. You know, coming from a small school like Mississippi Valley State University, coming into San Francisco where you got legends, you know, Montana from Notre Dame, Ronnie Lott from USC, Jerry Rice from Mississippi Valley State University.
What's wrong with this? Let me read what it says in the book because I think it's very telling. It's from the foreword with Bill Walsh. He says, I remember it like it was yesterday, though now it's been more than 20 years. It was the first day of the San Francisco 49ers minicamp in June 1985, and most of our veterans and recent draft picks had gathered at our practice facility to begin preparing to defend our Super Bowl title, which we had won just 5 months earlier. It didn't take very long that first day of practice for players and coaches alike to stop and stare at the new kid on the block. A few even gave me an approving nod. A 6'2" physical specimen, first-round draft pick Jerry Rice, was so explosive at every step that I think we were all in shock. I knew right away that Jerry was destined for greatness. He was so unusual, so different in his style and movements, in the way he glided along the field and absorbed the ball on the move. I had never seen anything like it. What was it like for you, 1985?
I was scared to death, scared and just wanted to fit in. I wanted to find my place, and I think at first when I caught the football and I started running, some of the guys looked at me like, young guys trying to show off a little bit, but it was just that I wanted to impress, because when you come from a small school like that, you got so many people doubting you, and I knew I had to find my place, and I had to work my butt off, and I was able to do that, and I think the guys, they appreciated that.
What is the difference between coming out of USC, Florida State, Michigan, Ohio State, and Mississippi Valley State when you're drafted?
I think playing in the big games, being in the spotlight, knowing how to deal with the media, and for me, I had to learn on the go. It was, just like Dancing with the Stars. I had to learn on the go, and no one is going to have sympathy for you, because you're going to have to learn fast and you're going to have to adapt. And I was able to do that. And I was also, I think the most important thing, I was able to keep everything in perspective. I never lost sight. If I had success, I wanted to give that success, I wanted to credit my teammates. And because football is not an individual game, it's a team sport.
Culturally, what was it like coming to San Francisco?
Scared to death. What are you talking about? Hey, coming from a very, very, small town, then all of a sudden you come to the big city and you got lights, camera, action. I'm like, oh, my God. I stepped off the plane. I wanted to turn around and go back home. But, I fought through that. And when I first came in also, it was one of those scenarios where, my agent, he wanted to change me, being this country boy. So, I had a speech therapist. I went through all of that. And I said, Jerry, you just got to be yourself. You be yourself, everything else is going to work out.
Was there anything that was a little bit embarrassing at the beginning for you?
My country accent, yeah. Yeah,
I remember. Yeah.
I was straight up country. I'm still country.
Those early days in the camp, you mentioned about kind of having to prove yourself again. You're absolutely right. You have to check your ego at the door. And probably for somebody that comes out of a small school like you, you have to show them that you deserve to be there.
Right, exactly. And I had my work cut out for me, and I was ready for it, because I have always worked hard. That's one thing about me. I never want anything to be given to me. But I had to prove to those guys that I deserve to be on that field and also be the starter.
When you came in, Joe Montana was here, of course, quarterback. The team had come off winning a Super Bowl. What was the atmosphere on that team?
Well, I just felt we would go back to the Super Bowl, because of the guys and the legacy. The dynasty was unbelievable because the track record, the best quarterback, the best owner, the best coach, so many great players. I just felt like we would go back, and came up a little short. And I still remember that game against the New York Giants. I caught that slant pattern and I was off to the races, and all of a sudden that ball popped out and it was rolling on the ground. And after that, we never did gain momentum from that. I think that one play taught me that I have to protect the football.
Was that the game also that Jim Burt hit Joe Montana?
No, that was the one here in San Francisco.
Okay, because I remember that. I mean, I thought he had been knocked into Thursday.
Yeah.
It was amazing. Jerry, you talked about your work ethic. I know that goes back to the family. You and I have talked about your dad and everything. But if you had to define it down to the minutest point, what is it about Jerry Rice that has that burning work ethic desire?
I think it's just that I'm just hungry. I'm hungry. I like challenges. Football is something that I'm not going to be able to replace that. It's just no way. That was 20 years of just excitement for me, and I poured my heart into that. But, you know, I have other things I want to accomplish off the football field now. I have a reality show that I'm going to start with TLC that I'm very excited about. It's going to be called Jerry Rice's Life Squad. It's going to be very inspirational. And I wanted TLC to take this on because I wanted it to be a family show. So I'm excited about that. Then working with Eddie DeBarlow again, doing Sirius Radio, and just dabbing in so many things, and I'm having a great time.
Was it hard for you to get to the end of your career? Because you love this game so much. I always sensed that it was going to be difficult for you to take off the uniform the last time.
Yeah, it was hard for me to get to the end. I have to be honest with you. And Mike Shanahan, we talked about that, and he told me, he said, Jerry, if you come to Denver, I'm always going to be straight up with you. I'm going to tell you if you're going to make the team or if you're going to be able to play a significant part. It didn't work out for me. I decided that it was time for me to walk away. And after that, I did some other things. I did pros and joes and stuff like that, trying to find my way because it's hard to make that transition. A lot of guys cannot make that transition after football.
And also, when you did make that decision, did you not look back? Did you second guess it to any degree, or was it done and over?
You know what? Of course not. You're going to look back. You're going to look back, and you're going to look and say, hey, look, I'm better than that guy. You know, I should still be out there on that football field. Some of the receivers, you know, you had some guys dropping footballs all over the place. I think one of my fellow teammates, Terrell Owens, he led the league with drops. He had 18. Randy Moss wanted to play at times. Then he didn't want to play. But, yeah, you know, you look at that and say, hey, you know, I would love to be back out there again.
Jerry Rice has joined us here on Sports Byline. Again, I want you to check out this book because it's not just a football book. It's a life story as well. It's called Go Long, My Journey Beyond the Game and the Fame. I alluded to it before the break. The man that you called your West Coast father, we're referring to, yeah, of course, Bill Walsh. First time you met him, did you meet him when he was scouting you, or when did you first meet Bill?
When I got drafted by the Niners and I came in town and I looked at this guy, silver hair, and I said, that guy, you know, and he had the nickname Genius, and it was just amazing because without Bill Walsh, I really don't think I would have gotten drafted by the San Francisco 49ers. And because the Dallas Cowboys, I think they had the next pick, and somehow Bill decided to make a trade, slide down one slot in front of the Cowboys, and they chose me.
Do you know why he chose you?
You know, just reading that, I think because he was so impressed with the way I was able to run my routes and the way I really, you know, just snatched the football out of the air. And I guess it was real, it was like, it was just perfect. And he took a chance. The guy, he was able to see down the road. And that was something that was really special. And I think Bill pretty much took me on his wings. And when I was having adversity, he just told me, Jerry, look, just keep working hard. He said, you're going to be good, you know, in this in the NFL. Just keep working.
Let me tell you a little bit, because I've talked to him, yeah, about this. And I asked him, I said, what was it about Jerry Rice that you saw that you liked? He said, I had talked to some people in Mississippi who talked to me about the way he conducted himself. So I knew he was disciplined. He said, you could see on tape that he had an explosive first step. And he said, that's what I looked for as well. And then the third thing that caught my attention from a technical standpoint, he told me, was the way he finished the play. He said, I put all three of those things together, and I felt he was going to be a star.
Wow. Wow. And it's just amazing because Bill really just played a very important part in my life. And we talk about this for, you know, and we would laugh about this. And Bill used to tell me, he said, you need to retire. You need to retire. You're playing too long. You know, I want to be the one to introduce you, you know, induct you into the hall. And we talked about that. So I really want this guy you know, to fight through this because he's been a father. He's been everything to me. And I think it's only appropriate that, you know, he's the one to induct me into the Hall.
I was recently having lunch with him, and I asked him about why he was so interested in diversification, meaning as far as that he didn't care if you were black, purple, pink, whatever it was. And he said, I grew up in Los Angeles, and he said, the community that I grew up in, we were poor but didn't know we were poor. So he could relate to your background. And he said, there were people that spoke Italian, they spoke Spanish, you know, there were guys from the hood and everything. He said, so I never saw things in terms of black and white, and I always felt that that was one of the strengths of him in molding this football team. He looked for production and really knew how to manipulate. And I use
oh,
that
yes,
in a
he did. Yeah. Oh, yes, he did.
You and everybody else to play their best games.
Yeah, and I had a game against the team. I think I had like 8 to 10 catches. I had 2 scores. I had over 100 yards or more. And Bill brought me into his office. And I'm thinking he's going to pat me on my back and say, hey, Jerry, great game, stuff like that. He looked at me, and he was serious. He looked at me, and he said, I need more from you. And he really meant that. But later on, I found out he brought in Joe Montana. He brought in all the other guys, too. So he knew how to motivate players. And you don't see a lot of that in coaching right now. You know, a guy that, you know, you're willing to just go out there and just lay everything on the line for.
Yeah. Manipulation is such a negative word. But I suppose he understood what it took for players to perform at their best. Did he always give you guys the feeling that he was the captain on the bridge of the ship?
Oh, yes.
I think that means an awful lot to players to know that.
Oh, yes. You knew that he was the captain. And if you didn't go out there and perform during the week, then he was going to let you know it. You had to perform. I think Tom Rathman, he was dropping balls. And I think Tom had just came in. It was his first year. And he told Tom, you keep dropping balls like that, you're not going to be here. And Tom said that really just woke him up, because he was just straight up front with him. And, you know, Bill, he was that type of coach, and you wanted to go out there and fight for it. And I think that's why we, you know, won so many Super Bowls.
I often wondered whether he had white hair before or after Russ Francis. I mean, Russ Francis drove him absolutely nuts, because he never practiced the way he wanted him to, but he played, you know, fine when it came to the, you know, came to the game itself.
Yeah, Russ, he was one of those tough guys, man. You know, he, I think he flew our airplane, did all of that stuff. And him and Bill, they used to go at it. But we had players, we had leaders that pretty much knew what we had to do, and to go out there and fight week in and week out. And we enjoyed, the most important thing, we enjoyed performing in front of the fans, you know. And whenever you played Candlestick Park, you knew that you had the backing of the fans, because they were going to show up and they were going to support us.
One of the things that you talk about in this book, and it surprised me, was the racism that you ran into in San Francisco. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Well, you're always going to face racism. You know that. It's still out there. And when I was growing up as a kid, I did the same thing. You know, to bring money into the house, I had to pick cotton. And a lot of the blacks that was down south, they didn't like that. You know, they felt like you were, you know, that it was a slap, you know, against your forefathers. But still, I had to bring money into the house, and the most important thing was to feed the family. So you're always going to encounter that, but we didn't use that as an excuse. We treated everybody equal. You know, it didn't matter about your skin. And my mom, she would always say this, you know, it's not about what you have. You know, it's about, you know, just family and love. And we had a very large family, but we were very close.
But it does get old after a while. Nobody should have to deal with that.
Yeah,
Jerry?
But you don't give in to it. You know, if you face it, hey, use it as a positive. Keep trying to really achieve your goals. And I fought through it. And I don't have a racist bone in my body. And I owe that to my parents.
Does it ever bother you that you were an athlete of renown and that people would relate to you because of your success? In other words, I know Jerry Rice. I want to know Jerry Rice.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You knew that. I knew exactly what was going on there, and I knew how to deal with it. You know, you have advantages, you have disadvantages. But the thing about me, I didn't let that stop me from being a leader. You know, if you put me down or something like that, I came back. I came back fighting. I wanted to prove you wrong.
It'll be a long time before we see another receiver as good as Jerry Rice. Across the bay from San Francisco is Oakland, and that's where Tom Flores had his great sports success. Flores wasn't a superstar player, but he became a Super Bowl-winning head coach not once, but twice with the Raiders. The Raiders have always been a unique organization, starting at the top with their owner, Al Davis. His motto has always been, "Just win, baby." Flores did just that, as he is only one of two men to have a Super Bowl ring as a player, an assistant coach, and a head coach. He played quarterback for the Silver and Black for six seasons and then coached them to a championship in 1980 as the first wild card team to win a Super Bowl. He won his second ring in 1983. Even though he went to later coach the Seattle Seahawks, he's most remembered for his long tenure as a player and a coach with Oakland. And he wrote about it all in his book, Tales from the Oakland Raiders. I asked Flores the obvious first question, what is it about the Raiders as an organization and a team that makes them so different?
I just think it's the atmosphere that was created through the years by the organization. And, you know, and you have to give a lot of that credit to Al Davis when he came, because Al, you know how he is. He's always been a mysterious type of person and likes to be known as a kind of a mystique type of individual. But we never laundered our stuff in the public. Everything that was done, we tried to keep it in-house, and we allowed players to be their personalities develop, some of them a little wacky, but we controlled them as long as they did what we wanted them to do, and that was play football, study hard, work hard, and win football games, and don't embarrass the organization. You know, it's not a perfect system, but once you establish that kind of a legacy, that kind of an atmosphere, the players every year hand it over to somebody else. And it's going to be interesting to see, you know, 10 years from now, whether that will continue, because today's modern player is a lot different than the players when I coached and when I played, as far as their commitment to an organization or their loyalties and their camaraderie.
Take me back to how you got involved with this organization first as a player.
Well, I came out of College of Pacific and now University of Pacific in Stockton, and I went to Canada and failed there. I had shoulder surgery. Tried out with the Redskins in 59, failed there. And then in 60, when the American Football League started, they were signing anybody. Oakland got the last franchise available. They were originally, it was originally given to Minnesota, but they gave it to Oakland. And a bunch of guys got together, a bunch of Chet Soda and Wayne Valley and Ed McGaw and about 20 limited partners all got together and put up, you know, $5,000, $25,000 apiece, you know, big money in those days. And we were born. And so I signed. There were 11 quarterbacks the first day of camp in Santa Cruz. We all couldn't get one picture. I mean, it was almost a zoo. And somehow we survived, we persevered, and who would have thought that it would grow to what it is today? We played our first games were in Kezar Stadium. And then we ended up playing in Candlestick, and then the last three games of the 60 year, and then the entire 61, then we started little old Frank Yule Field in Oakland. So I've been with them since day one, and that's what the book reflects from day one and all the way through my career with the Raiders.
Tom, let me go back to day one of the AFL and the Oakland Raiders as well. Those were very interesting days. The league was born out of a desire to take on the established National Football League. What was it like in those early days?
Well, we got second billing, third billing. I mean, we were behind the rodeo and the ping pong tournaments. Very rarely did we ever make any front page in the sporting news. San Francisco treated us like we were, you know, they said, those guys. But most of the players were great. The 49er players, they were great. I mean, they were, you know, because they respected our abilities. Our abilities weren't any different than them. Than theirs, but we didn't have as many good players as the National Football League did. So, and plus it created more jobs, and we weren't hurting anybody. We weren't hurting their gate at all. But it was we would be back east, and they'd look at us and say, "Are you guys professional football players?" And I said, "Yeah." Sometimes we'd say we're truck drivers, and we would be paged once in an airport. We were paged as, "Will the Oklahoma Raiders please report to gate 2? Your plane is leaving." So, funny things would happen like that. Some of the traveling, I mean, we would go back east and play Buffalo, Boston, New York, and our travel agent would stay in New York, and we didn't even know where we were supposed to go or what plane or what station we were to get off of when we took a train. It was a unique experience, and we were just having fun. The guys who were playing played because they loved the game, and we were having fun.
Yeah, I mean, there are stories about players when they got their paychecks. They go right to the bank with their uniforms and their cleats on.
Well, I never went with my uniform, but I went right down there. And one time we went to the bank over by Lake Merritt in Oakland, and we sat there and waited until they had money, funds. And then we took it in cash. In New York City, Harry Wismer on the team, and there were checks bouncing all over town, and they had a little model. Let's get this one for the Jipper instead. Yeah, but Harry Wismer was an interesting guy. We played it in the Polo Grounds. Have you ever been? Do you remember the Polo Grounds?
I remember the Polo Grounds. Oh, never been there, but I remember them.
It was dark and ugly, and they were rat infested . And we'd be sitting there, and tonight's attendance, 25,400. And we turn around, and where? I mean, they must have been counting the animals in the park because there weren't 25,000. But that was Harry Wismer. He was a dramatic type of guy.
When you take a look at those early days, the players coming together around the league, there was a lot of talented players. Why did they not make it in the National Football League? Why was this league forced to be formed?
Well, I think there was. I think at that point it was a time where there were more players with ability to play professional football, and they didn't have many choices. Canada was the only choice, and in Canada they could only keep so many Americans, and their brand of football wasn't anything like the U.S. And so all of a sudden you have a better program starting to develop, and you had more players that were able to play professional football, and then there were some players in the National Football League that got cut. That hadn't matured yet. Lenny Dawson got cut, and he comes into our league, and he had an incredible career with the Chiefs and made the Hall of Fame. So there were players like Art Powell, who played with me, didn't make it in the NFL because they had him as a defensive back with Philadelphia. But he was a great wide receiver, and he in any era he would have been a great wide receiver. So I just think that was a time where you saw there were more players. The black players were coming out of the black colleges, and there were Buck Buchanan and big Ernie Ladd and Willie Brown and on, and all of a sudden they were making their mark in professional football in both leagues. So I think that was just a turning point as far as more players, and now there's even more players. Of course, there's 32 teams now. The NFL only had, I think, 10 teams, and AFL started out with 8.
Yeah, I really believe that the AFL was really the incubator for the opportunity for black athletes in professional football. I mean, because there were no labels put on the athletes back then. There was a chance to develop this offense, this wide-open offense, because the NFL was rather staid to some degree. Would you agree with that statement?
Well, to a certain extent, yeah. I mean, you take Washington, Washington was still all white. They had not allowed a black player until the early 60s, and I think they were almost forced to if they wanted to compete with the rest of the teams. So when you went into the 60s, there was that change, and also the change was starting to develop in the colleges, where the major colleges were now starting to recruit black athletes, into Oklahoma, into Texas, into the major colleges in order to compete, because they all, they realized, hey, these guys are they're players and they're students and they're individuals, and why not? Does this improve our programs and improve their programs?
What was that first team meeting like for the Raiders?
Well, it was Eddie Ertelatz was an interesting guy because he didn't believe in long meetings. He was at Navy. He came from Navy, and at Navy they had like 45 minutes of practice one day. They had an hour the next day. Their meetings were very short. So we would meet. I mean, our meetings were half hour meetings. Our practices were sometimes 45 minutes. We would sprint everywhere we went, and we were the best conditioned team in the league. And because of that, we won 6 games the first year. And then the next year, we didn't improve our talent at all. We just got killed. We won 2 games, I think, because we just weren't good enough to compete with everybody that had gotten better. And then after that, 62 was even worse. And then 63, we finally came around when Al came to town.
Tom, you mentioned about things started to improve when Al Davis came aboard. Al Davis's background was a kid that came off the streets of Brooklyn, and he brought that attitude really to the West Coast, did he not?
Well, he always considered himself kind of a street guy, even though he wasn't, but he liked to think of it, and his attitude was that way. And, me against the world, and probably still does a little bit. But he loved the game of football. He had done everything. He was He went to Syracuse. He never was, you know, he didn't play a lot, but he was on the squad. He was a student assistant. He taught. He was a coach in the Army. He coached at the Citadel, at USC, in a great program. And then I think the best move that he ever made was when he went with Sid Gilman in 1960 in the AFL. And for 3 years, he learned as much as he could from Sid, who was a master, and developed his own personality and his own style of play and a reputation, because when he was hired, he wasn't that well known around the entire country. And I had heard of him, but I didn't know that much about it. But the very first day I met him and we got on the board, I mean, we had known each other for a half hour, and we were on the chalkboard going over what he wanted to do offensively. And I started smiling. He looked at me like, "What are you smiling about?" I said, "No, I just like what you're doing up there. It was fun for a quarterback. If you didn't like that kind of system, it was something wrong, because we're going to throw the ball and buckle up, because here we come." But he also knew how to organize a professional team. And up until that point, we were not really organized that well. And he had complete control, and he also had a great feel for talent. And immediately he brought in players, and we went from 1-13 to 10-4 in 63. So that was a big turnaround.
Tom, you mentioned about things started to improve when Al Davis came aboard. What were his expectations of players and as the team of a whole, as a coach?
Well, I think the one thing that he wanted to throw the ball up the field, and he wanted backs that could run and catch the ball out of the backfield. Speed was always a big concern of his. And he went out and got Art Powell in a trade. He picked Clem Daniels, who became a feature back out of the backfield. I think in 64, he got Billy Cannon, who ended up playing tight end. Tight end could run down the field. He drafted Biletnikoff. You know, these were big offensive linemen. So he had, this was what he did, and this was what they did in San Diego. That's what Sid Gilman's theory was. So he tried to surround the team and the players with quality players and then fill in between the lines.
Tom, what was the foundation of the mystique and also the philosophy and the personality of the Raiders? Because I have found it to be unique compared to other organizations. They all have a personality, but I know, as most people know, and you alluded to it a little bit earlier, they give players a second chance. It's kind of an us against them. They're a very close-mouthed organization. It's hard to get any type of information out of them at all. And I think a lot of that's been fostered in order to maintain kind of a motivation. But what was the foundation of all of that?
Well, it's hard to say what the foundation, because it just kind of happened through the years. You don't even think about it when it's going on. But obviously, we were always a close group. Football players are a close group anyway, because they hang out together there in training camp. We were in training camp Al's first year for 9 weeks. We went to camp right after the 4th of July. We didn't break till Friday before the first league game. So all that closeness in training camps, and when you travel together, and then the way that we were protected from the outside, keep it inside. That was always stressed. Keep it inside. Everything that happens is in this room. And there was a loyalty with the players, within the players, and then there was a loyalty with the organization to the players that developed through the years. So once a Raider, always a Raider. And then that is handed down through generations from player to player. When we got a new player, and he came in that locker room, he was treated just like anybody else. He wasn't treated like some outsider, which a lot of teams are there. And I've had players and former players come up and say, "God, you guys are amazing." I say, "You get together and you're just like yesterday." See, we never get together. I mean, we don't have that kind of feeling. We never had that kind of feeling when we were with the team we were with. And I said, well, that's just the way we lived. Everybody got a chance, and everybody did their thing.
Yeah. When you take a look at the players that came together in those early days, did they set the tone for the later years teams that came along? Because I've always felt that the good organizations were the ones that, when you came into them, they said, wait a minute, this is the way we do it as the Raiders.
Yeah, no question. That's what I meant by the legacy lives on, because the players, the locker room, the coaches, they pass it on to the next generation. Even though, some coaches have gotten fired, but still they remember, players have gotten cut or traded, and they remember, and their feelings are still with the Raiders. But there's so much that goes on off the field that helps establish that type of a feeling. And then, you know, as the game got bigger and bigger, that got bigger and bigger. And then players sometimes they can hardly, well, what's, you know, what's so neat about the Raiders? And then they get here and then they say, wow, this is a pretty good place. You know, it's nice in here. You know, the players are treating me nice. And, you know, as long as you do what you have to do, and this is what they got you for. You play hard, study hard, practice hard, you know, and then, you know, you can do your own thing whenever you have time. But one thing about the players, don't you do anything to screw up this team. Because they would take care of it.
Mm-hmm. What's the myth and what's the fact about Al Davis, both as a person and also as a football administrator?
Well, I think he's a brilliant man. I think he had such vision even way back then on what was around the corner, what he felt was going to happen. And I mean, he knew years before it happened that you know, we were going to have to do this in order to win. We were going to have to do this in order to win. And He dedicated himself to the game of football. Now, you know, Pete, you might question some of the things that he's done, but I don't think that he's ever done anything to hurt the game. He's done things to get an advantage or where he felt some things were done unfairly. He's, you know, created some, you know, some
animosity.
Yeah, animosity. But Al is very loyal to those who have been loyal to him. You'll never hear – I have a little chapter in the book about him. And you'll never hear about it because it's not news. The news is when he sues somebody or something like that. But he and Pete Rozelle always went head-to-head, but both of them had one thing in common. They loved the game, and they did everything they could to promote and make the game better. Tex Schramm was the same way. You know, these guys were the ones that set the standards for professional football. But Al has always been that way. He's always been tenacious. You'd want him as your best friend. You wouldn't want him as your worst enemy. He's been a winner, and when you think he's down, he comes back. But he's also very loyal and very kind. There's a lot of things about him that people don't know about.
Yeah, I want to talk about that a little bit later on. And I'm just wondering, as the game has changed, as society has changed, I'm just wondering whether it's been hard for Al Davis to adapt.
I don't think it has. I don't really think it has. You know, he's losing a lot of his friends. You know, Sid Gilman passed away, and a lot of the guys are his good friends are no longer around. But you know, he has tried to stay on top of things, and the things that he believes in that make a winner are still the same things that people are winning with. You know, size, speed has always been a big factor, and getting the best players and making sure that they play up to their abilities and making sure that they're directed properly. You know, it took him a while to find the good mix in coaches. He got John Gruden, and John Gruden was a great coach for the Raiders. And when he left to get something for himself. And it worked out good for both teams because Callahan took over and didn't miss a beat.
What will be his legacy at some point when he does leave the game or does pass away, you think?
Well, I think he'll be remembered as, you know, he's already in the Hall of Fame, and there will be a lot of stories, and probably most of them not true, but he'll be remembered as a unique football person that lived the game and left the game as his legacy. The Raiders will be his legacy because this is his pride and joy, the Raiders.
Yeah, and what I will find interesting is that the perception of him from the outside will be different from what it was from the inside of those that wore the uniform, because you alluded to it just a little, but you alluded to the fact that he was always there for his players, not only when they played for the Raiders, but also after they played for the Raiders as well.
Yeah, he was, and still is.
Yes.
To this day. And he doesn't remember. He doesn't forget. He doesn't forget. I mean, you could be sitting in your living room and all of a sudden the phone will ring and say, "How you doing? You know, what can I do for you if you have a problem?"
I do want to touch on the move from Oakland to Los Angeles, because there are teams that take on the personality of the community they happen to be in. And I don't know that maybe the Pittsburgh Steelers, a lot of people say the Steelers have that personality of that town as well. I certainly think that the Raiders had the personality of the East Bay, blue collar and everything. Talk to me about that personality when they were in Oakland. And then when they moved down to Los Angeles, Tom, what happened then?
Well, I was. We moved to LA and started playing in Los Angeles in '82, and then I started in '79. So, '79, I was just getting my feet wet, and there was already the rumbling about the unhappiness in the Coliseum not wanting to do certain things. And I thought that had all settled after the 79 season, and so I went off to the Pro Bowl just to go see the Pro Bowl and get away for a few days. And when I came back, it all hit the fan, and all of a sudden, you know, from good to bad. And then, but we won the Super Bowl in 80 in Oakland, and it was great. I mean, you know, it's good to. It was our second Super Bowl victory, my first one as a head coach, and things were going well. But still, the uncertainty of whether we were going to be there or not. And then 81, obviously, the decision was made, so we were kind of like a lame duck team. We hadn't played in LA, excuse me. We played our first game in San Francisco in 1982, and then our second game was in Atlanta, and then we went on an eight-week strike without a game. So we stayed in Oakland rather than move down to LA, finished the season practicing in Oakland and flying down to LA for every home game and then flying to wherever we had to go for every away game. So, and then the following year, we 83, we went to Santa Rosa again, and when we broke camp, we went down to LA, and most of us lived in hotels, so I lived in a hotel for 14 months.
Tom Flores, a man who personifies Al Davis's mantra of just win, baby. Finally, let's talk some baseball. Most who know the game will tell you that Darrell Evans was probably the most underrated player to put on a major league uniform. He played for Atlanta, San Francisco, and Detroit over a successful 21-year career. Primarily a third baseman, Evans was the first player to hit 40 home runs in both leagues, and he was the first 40-year-old to hit 40 homers in a season. And he hit more than 400 home runs during his career. Now that's success. His career was also marked with a World Series title with the Detroit Tigers. I find it impressive when any athlete can play their sport for double-digit years, so I asked Evans if it impresses him that he was able to play for more than 20 years.
Yeah, I don't even know if that was really me, Ron. you know, it was so long that you kind of go through generations. We've been talking about that, you know, with alumni associates. You go back and see guys that you played with and played against, and then guys that have been out of the game 10 or 12 years now, and you played against them too. So I played in a great era and a bunch of fun and three great ball clubs and three great sports cities and had so much fun. I can't tell you. I think I was the luckiest guy in the world.
What does it take to be able to play that long at this level?
Well, I think, you know, you got to be lucky in a lot of ways. I mean, health-wise, obviously, talent-wise. And I think a lot of it, too, was that I kept getting incentives. You know, I came up as a young player with the Braves and all those great teams with four Hall of Famers on the team and a veteran team that taught me a lot. And I had Eddie Matthews there who really helped make me a player. Learned how to play the game, and then could kind of take that when I got over the Giants to a team that was a little younger and kind of bring a little bit more of that. And then we got really good. They made some great trades with Vida and those kind of things, and we got in a chance to be in the playoffs and all that kind of, you know, you just kind of forget about it. And then when I went to the Tigers as a 37-year-old old guy that the Giants basically, you know, didn't want to, not they didn't want me, but it was just that they didn't want to keep me around for two or three years. Went to a perfect situation where I got to be part of a young ball club that was hungry. I didn't really have to be the main guy all the time or one of them. And so you just kind of keep playing. And people keep asking you, how can you do this? And you go, well, you know, I never thought that I would ever have to wake up. You know, if I could still play Thursday night, have a good game Thursday night, I didn't think waking up Friday morning I was going to be through. So it became an incentive, actually, to kind of not prove to people, but say, hey, you know what? I got a chance to keep playing this game as long as I want to, as long as I'm successful, because I've been lucky enough to get in good situations here and contribute. And you learn that different times you contribute different things. As a young player, you just kind of follow along. And then when you're an older player, you can do so much more than just what you do on the field. And that becomes your incentive for playing.
How important is it to be in the right place at the right time as an athlete? You're laughing, so I think I know the answer.
I think it's pretty important, yeah. Well, like I say, you know, just what I was talking about, just so many times, the first time I got traded, the time I got traded to the Giants was such a traumatic thing because I wasn't playing very good. The first time I really hadn't played baseball good for a long, long time. It was a scary feeling. You kind of feel like nobody wants you. And then getting over here, all of a sudden I got rejuvenated because now it was like I was a part of a team that didn't know how bad I was playing at the time, and they wanted me over here and got part of this with the rivalry and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, that was a big boost. I could have, you know, if I wouldn't have been playing on a good ball club in Atlanta and then gotten to a good ball club with the Giants, basically, you know, your career could be over if you don't really perform. But I had a chance to kind of get come back from that kind of stuff. So those kind of things happen. And then, again, like I say, you know, how many times you could just go out there and sprain your ankle, step in a hole. You know, things happen off the field. You get hurt. And I was never on the disabled list. So I the only times I got hurt were in the off season, I guess. So that part of it you can't control either. So I don't know. Like I said, I was just I was blessed in a lot of ways. And I was hungry to keep playing, so I learned how to play hurt, and I played, you know, didn't ever want to give anybody an excuse to not play me.
Those first 9 years with the Atlanta Braves, I've always said that mentoring was such an important part in professional sports. Somebody takes the young player underneath their wing. You mentioned about the veteran players that were in Atlanta. We don't see that today because players are rushed through the minor leagues. They're brought up. If they don't make it there, they're moved on to another organization. Talk to me about those veteran players and how they helped you and what it was like being on a veteran Atlanta team.
Well, I think that's you made a perfect point because the veteran players now haven't been, and it's been probably a couple generations now, where they haven't really spent a lot of time in the minor leagues. Not that they didn't earn their spot, but to really appreciate how you got there and why you were there and what your responsibility is after you get there. I mean, you're playing at the top level. There's no other level to go. When you're in the minor leagues, you're playing basically for yourself. Sure, you want to win, and you're trying to win ball games and everything, but you get moved up. And as you get to the big leagues, all of a sudden there's no other league to play in. And you realize that those guys that have been there for a while, you're playing with a bunch of men that want to kick your butt. And they're not going to let you, you know, they're not going to let you come in there without some respect and earning that. And I think that that was a big thing playing longer and longer that you realize that, I mean, Hank Aaron and Phil Niekro and Orlando Cepeda and Rico Carty, just sitting there listening to how they played the game and how they expected everyone else to play the game because they were already at the top level. It wasn't that they were satisfied playing themselves, but they weren't satisfied unless everybody played to that level. So I think if you don't understand that, you don't really get the most out of that your career.
You know, I've said this, and I know you're going to agree with me on this, Darryl, and that is with good ball clubs, good organizations, championship ball clubs, no matter what the sport, the discipline and the direction of that team comes out of the clubhouse, comes out of the locker room. It doesn't come from the manager or the general manager. And you mentioned about those veteran players saying, hey, this is the way we play Atlanta baseball. This is the way we play Dodger baseball. And I really think that is one of the things that's missing in the game today.
Well, you look at the Braves. Look at the Braves have made such a long run. Why is that? I mean, they've made a lot of turnovers. They've had, but, you know, their veteran key veteran players are pretty much the same guys. They were taught how to play. This is the way it's going to be here. No matter whether you got great credentials or you're a young superstar, so what? That doesn't really matter up here in the big leagues. It matters in how you get along. You know, I look back and I don't know, my 5 or 6 years where I've been in a pennant race and lost by 1 or 2 games. And you look back and you go, you know what? It wasn't because I didn't get another hit or make another play or do anything. It was because of the way the team played. And in the long run, when you do win, you realize that that's what it's all about. It's not one guy having great years, and it's not one guy doing a special thing. It's everybody being on the same page all the time. And you can lose the pennant in April and in May just as easily as you do it at the end, because then when you got to win ball games, you should have won. You look back and you go, man, I'm going to spend all 4 or 5 months in the winter agonizing over this thing. And after a while, you realize that, you know, when you walk into that clubhouse like I did, kind of in 84 with Detroit. They were hungry. I wasn't there before. And I wasn't even American League. I didn't really know those guys. I knew Sparky called me and said they were great players, and obviously they were. But they were hungry. They were not going to lose again, and they learned how to do that. And, you know, you just wish that everybody gets a taste of that, because once you get a taste of it, it never happens again. And then you've got so many guys that are on that page that when someone new comes in, they have to play that way. And until you do that, you know, all the teams that win, I mean, we look back, sure, there's free agency, but the majority of the teams that win have come from within, and they've played together for a long time, and they realize it's new, and it's not about just you, what you're doing. It's about what everybody around you is doing.
Do you think the fact that players are rushed through the minor leagues because they're paid so much going in to the minor leagues before they even prove themselves, that the foundation for these players is not there when they reach the major leagues?
Well, sure. I think everything experience helps in any way. And some of them, you know, sometimes now I'm a manager, and I've been a manager for a long time and a coach. And one of the things that you got to find out about players is that most of them have been successful and have not lost, or they have not had a bad year or been disappointed for even a couple of weeks. And that's when you find out really how they know how to play the game and whether you can count on them. And some of them, it takes longer to and they never get it. So they're not around, and you don't want those kind of people around, because you have to lose almost 50% of the time in baseball. So you have to come back from that and be better when you come back. And it's a great way of learning not only about baseball but life. So, yeah, I think it was a good thing to stay in the minor leagues longer. I know we don't – none of us want to do that. And we hear all these great stories about guys that stayed 8 or 10 years. You know, with what they get paid, they don't get – you know, that's hard to do and have families and everything. But the rewards are there. You know, you appreciate those guys even long, because they – when they come up, they have no problem. You know they know how to play.
Do you think the big money the players are getting going into the minor leagues, the multi-millions of dollars, changes motivation in a sense?
Well, it can, and I think it's an individual thing. I'm sure, you know, there's a lot of guys that love playing. And where I'm at in the independent league, they've all either come out of college, didn't get drafted, or didn't sign with somebody, or they've played and done pretty well and have been hurt and are coming back. Or they've been to the top. We have four guys who've been major league or triple A guys, but they're all hungry to play. So the motivation isn't necessarily the money. Some guys use that as a crutch because now when they and again probably because they've been super successful and have never lost and have never don't realize that now you're playing against the best players in the world. You're not always going to get a hit. You're not always going to be successful. And until that happens, until you learn how to do that, yeah, it could be the reason why more guys don't stick around on it.
Darrell Evans has joined us on Sports Byline. We're talking a little baseball with the former third baseman who started his career at Atlanta and then moved over to the San Francisco Giants. You mentioned about how traumatic it was. What was it that made it so traumatic for you? Was it going from East Coast to West Coast, going or just being traded or moved for the first time?
Well, you know what? You kind of want to feel loved all the time. And when nobody, you know, when you're not hitting, not playing very good, you don't have many friends, Ron. You know, nobody wants to talk to you. You know, because no one knows how. I mean, everybody feels for you. But when you're not playing very good and not doing especially, you know, I was counted on to do something big time there. You know, with Hank Aaron and then Eddie Matthews, of course, and then Dusty Baker and I kind of came in there. We were kind of thought of as the new Aaron and Matthews. And I know that's not a fair thing to put on any kid. But, you know, you kind of people expect certain things. When you're not doing them, you know, they just don't know what to say to you. And, you know, like I said, you know, nobody sit next to me in the dugout very much. They didn't want the stuff to rub off. And I really, it was the first time I really gone through a time where, not that I wasn't playing very good, but I was just playing terrible. I just couldn't do anything right. And you start feeling sorry for yourself and all that kind of stuff. And I had one great moment during that time. A guy that had scouted me in high school and college ended up being at the ball game and came down before the game. And, you know, I'm moping around, all that kind of stuff. And he goes, "Hey, what's wrong with you?" And I go, "Well, I'm just not here." He goes, "No, I don't mean that." He goes, "You're not playing the game like you used to play the game." That really woke me up. That was, and kind of put things in perspective, that you don't have any control over what you hit, how many home runs you do, and whether you make errors and all that kind of stuff. You have control of how you go about it. And that was probably the best thing that happened to me. That was a blessing in disguise. So it was great that it was a big disappointment that they didn't want me. It's not that they didn't want me with the Braves. They had to make a trade. They had to make Jimmy Wynn and myself. Jimmy Wynn was a free agent at the time, and we both were just got off to terrible starts. They had to make some, and they were expected to win. Got Willie Montanez, who was a good trade for them. And I got to come and come home, closer in the West Coast. That was a neat thing, and I think that made it more comfortable. If I'd have gone to some other cities, well, I don't want to mention here, but, you know, that might have been a little different. But coming to a great city, and, you know, I grew up watching that giant Dodger rivalry, and even though my family was kind of Dodger, you know, they're Dodger fans, although they claimed they weren't when I was playing for the Giants, I found out later now that that's not true. But, you know, that was exciting in itself to be part of that and see what that was going to be like. And, of course, that took off when I got, you know, in the late 70s, it became a big deal again.
Yeah. You know, they talk about the Yankee-Boston-Red Sox rivalry, and that's one rivalry. But the one on the West Coast here, how does it differentiate between a rivalry still on the East Coast? Because I do think that they're discernibly different.
Well, if you live on the East Coast, do you think that's a bigger deal than it is out here? That's basically it. But, you know, that's become kind of a rivalry lately. As you look back with the Giants and the Dodgers, I mean, the more you hear from people, and now that it's gotten farther and farther in the past, people still, I hear this all the time, you know, I was a Brooklyn Dodger fan. I was a New York Giant fan. Killed me. It broke my heart that they moved out. Anytime we go to New York or any place around there, people still talk about that. So it's sure the Boston, the Red Sox and Yankee kind of has been become a big thing because they're both have won some pennants now and been in the press and all that kind of stuff a little more. But, you know, the Dodger-Giant rivalry that moved from New York out to here, unless you've kind of been part of that. And, you know, we're on the left coast here, so we don't kind of, you know, we don't shape up to a lot of other places back there. We don't get as much publicity for it. And maybe because somebody's got to win this thing. If one of the teams wins, and, you know, it'll be back in the news again, and it'll be just as important. But, you know, whatever team you're a fan of, it doesn't matter. You're a fan of that team, and that rivalry is the most important thing.
What is the difference between the fans as they view the rivalry and the way the players view it?
Well, I think the players, it takes longer for the players because the players haven't been there. The fans have been there. They've lived it. I mean, you know, you know, when people will their season tickets and you see the same people, you know, and back here from Candlestick to the new ballpark now, same people. I've gone out there, and there's a lot of same people out there, the vendors and all kinds of stuff. So that tradition's carried on. The players, because you move around unless you've been part of that. And I grew up in L.A. and hated the Dodgers when that was happening. So, you know, I became a big fan of that. And that was such a boost to us all because I look back now and the way that Detroit's going crazy because of, you know, the same way it was in 84, watching every night, people would can't wait to when the Dodgers and Giants are playing. And it was just in the community. So it was, if you really looked around and if you were part of the ball club for a little while, it made you get caught up in that whole thing and you could hardly wait. You know, we used to love having, you know, Tommy walk out from, you know, from the bullpen to the dugout. There was always something going to happen. And, you know, I mean, fights and the intensity. I mean, we literally hated each other. I mean, not personally. You know, we're not off the field, but we're on the field.
Competitively.
I mean, well, you know, I think everybody, growing up, even in the minor leagues, I didn't like the Dodgers because they had, their uniforms were clean and tailored and everything else. We had all the hand-me-downs wherever I played. So it was just something that you kind of just had fun with, obviously. But it really made you play harder, and it really did involve the whole community.
I have to ask you a question because when I came here and you were on the team, Candlestick Park is where the Giants played. Now, you played in the launching pad that they called Atlanta Fulton County Stadium. The wind is what they always talked about, the cold, that the players didn't like it. What was the fact about that? How did the players feel about Candlestick?
Well, I think after a while, when you played it for a while, the same thing, you got to overcome it. You can't make it a big deal to you every single day. You're playing 81 games in the park that, you know, obviously we know the problems with it in some ways. And it seemed like you don't want to make it an excuse for losing. And I think that's what happens when the guys that first came in. You know, that was kind of, well, it's too cold. It's windy. I've been here before. I know there's something. But I think one of the big things that kind of gets overlooked is that it had sometimes something to do with who won the ball game. And I don't know if that ever evens out, you know, with the wind or whatever happened or, you know, what the weather and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it wasn't fun to go out there and hit and that stuff all the time, but you had to learn and maybe you had to get better at it, and we did. But I think back, you know, I think, you know what, if we would have played in another ballpark, maybe we would have won one time, one or two ball games that the wind blew a ball in or whatever. So I don't know if it evened up or not, but I just don't think it did. So I think that's more the way the players think because you got to go out and go to work. I mean, you eventually get used to it, not used to it, but you eventually just got to put up with it. And there was a lot of funny things that happened out there with the, you know, the mustard wrappers and, you know, I mean, I've seen people get hit with foul balls and just been laughing. You know, hats go to center field all the time. Just and, you know, when you're standing out there at third base and the ball's just about getting into the hitting area and you got somebody up there, Mike Schmidt or somebody, and all of a sudden there's a little whirlwind in your face and you can't see. Just all kinds of good stuff like that. So it was a fun place to play. It was a tough place to play because of that, but it was a beautiful place. It was in the major leagues, and I loved it.
Darrell Evans may not be fully appreciated, but he had a long, successful career and a championship ring to prove to himself he was pretty darn good. I hope you've enjoyed World Airways' in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA, and you'll listen to our live broadcasts on radio, the American Forces Network worldwide, Sirius Satellite Radio Channel 122, and the Internet. If you'd like a listing of Sports Byline's radio affiliates, be sure to check out our award-winning website at sportsbyline.com. I'm Ron Barr, and thanks for being a part of America's sports talk show, Sports Byline USA.